tactics.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. World's fairs were events where nations could show off their achievements to people from around the globe. And in the time before TV and the internet, people came by the millions to see what was new in the world. It was at World's fairs that many were first exposed to ceramics, to new developments in technology, to methods of creating arts and other objects that pushed the envelope of the imagination and what was humanly possible to achieve. And much of what was on display at these World's Fairs made fairgoers react in amazement. Interestingly, many of the objects that so astounded those who attended World's Fairs from 1851 to 1939 retains the power to amaze today, and thanks to the Mint Museum, you can see that for yourself. You'll want to, because much of what you will see at their recently opened World's Fair exhibit are items you've never seen before and are unlikely to see again, at least up close. Inventing the Modern World, Decorative Arts at the World's Fairs 1851 to 1939 is on display through January 19th, and we're going to try to whet your appetite for all that has to offer this hour. We're joined by Brian Gallagher, Curator of Decorative Arts at the Mint Museum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Stephen Plaxco is the museum's chief designer and the man who decided how to display the 200-some artifacts that take up space on two floors at the Mint. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Palmer is Director of Learning and Engagement at the Mint. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning, Mike.
The companion book to this exhibit, because all exhibits must have a companion book, is entitled Inventing the Modern World. But the exhibit highlights World's Fairs beginning in 1851. Was that the beginning of the modern world, 1851?
It really was in terms of these World's Fairs, Mike. Prior to 1851, France and England and maybe a few other countries had national trade fairs where they invited artists, craftsmen, designers from their country to come together and show the most recent products they've all been working on. But it really wasn't until 1851 in London when a fair was organized that brought together designers and artists from all over Europe. And in fact, the exhibition's title alludes to that. It was called the Great Exhibition of the Works of Industry of All Nations. It was held in Hyde Park in London, and some 6 million people attended.
Wow. That's pretty impressive for back then, because it took a while to get to any place in the world.
That's right. And in fact, many English people were visiting London for the first time just to attend that fair.
I thought that the last World's Fair in the United States was the 1964 World's Fair in New York in the Meadowlands, Flushing Meadows in New York. But I was wrong, because I remember talking on the radio to people in Louisiana in the mid-80s where they were holding the Louisiana World Exposition in 1984, and we sent a reporter down there, and I spoke to him several times as he would go from exhibit to exhibit. That was the last one in the United States, right?
I believe so, but the World's Fairs are still going on across the world. In 2011, Shanghai hosted one that attracted 73 million people, and there's one coming up in Milan in 2015. So they are still a reality. We just perhaps don't hear about them as much anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think that part of the problem is that the World's Fair in 1964 in New York was called the World's Fair. The one in Louisiana was the Louisiana World Exposition in 1984, so maybe people didn't make that connection. But there are a whole lot of people who are too young to remember 1984, and certainly too young to remember 1964 and what that World's Fair was like in New York. So talk to me about what these things were like. What was the experience like for fairgoers?
Well, I think today we have the world at our fingertips, because we can Google anything. We can get on our phone and get on our laptop and find the world at our fingertips. And in this particular period that the exhibition covers, 1851 to 1939, so before World War II, when truly the world changed, it was the time for the world to be in one place. And you could go to London, or you could go to Vienna, or you could go to Paris, and there would be pavilions from Japan and China and India and America. And
what
the
you're
best
describing
the brightest.
Sounds like Epcot Center at Disney World.
Well, I think Disney aspires to be a world's fair on this sort of stage.
Well, it kind of is. At least Epcot Center
is kind of like.
Is that where their inspiration came from for Epcot, for world's fairs?
I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, museums themselves owe a huge debt to World's Fairs, and a number of very notable museums got their start from World's Fairs. The Victoria and Albert Museum in London was founded in the year or two after this 1851 exhibition that starts off the exhibition at the Mint now. The St. Louis Art Museum was founded after the Louisiana Purchase Exposition in 1904. The Museum of Applied Arts in Vienna was founded after the 1873 Weltausstellung World's Fair in Vienna, and on and on. So it wouldn't at all surprise me if Disney was looking to these grand affairs in the way that cultural institutions have for inspiration.
The 1851 World's Fair in London had a structure built called the Crystal Palace.
That's right.
Which was associated with the building itself was something to see, evidently. Mm-hmm. And they they built it around enormous live trees. So there were live trees inside.
Right. That's correct.
The exhibit. I think the Eiffel Tower was built for a World's Fair.
For 1889.
That's right.
In Paris. And there have been other structures. I think the Globe. Is it a Globe that's outside in Flushing Meadows?
That's right.
That was part of the World's Fair in New York in 1964. Do all these World's Fairs have, or did they have, great structures, buildings, prominent features that were associated? They were just built for that fair, and how many of them still exist?
Oh gosh,
today?
I don't know how many still exist, but yeah, it was you know, a chance to kind of show off not just innovative products that were kind of within the fair, but you know, they poured a lot of money into the entire kind of a substructure and structure of the fairs by building, showing what their architects could do, what construction could do, also to just make it, you know, kind of a spectacular symbolic presence to represent the country that was throwing it. So yeah, like we said, in Flushing Meadows they still have the Globe, and they still have, there's another structure there I think with that. Every now and then, as I recall, I lived in New York for a while, they talk about taking it down, and it always manages to stay up.
Well, it's like the Hollywood sign. You don't take down the Hollywood sign. You don't take down that Globe. That's where, that's, you know, that's part of history now.
I think it is true. I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that I think in large part, a lot of the buildings that were built for these World's Fairs were ephemeral in nature. They really weren't meant to last. There are some notable exceptions to that, like the Eiffel Tower, as you mentioned, and those in your listening audience have been to Paris and gone to the Musée d'Orsay, for instance. Well, that was originally a train station that was built to help transport people in and out of Paris for the 1900 Paris Exposition. The subway stations in Paris were likewise put in place in 1900 for that fair. So there are remnants.
Do you mean the subway stations, or do you mean the decorative nature of the entrance?
Well, the subway stations were the line itself was built, okay. But then, as some may know, there are some of those stations have these wonderful Art Nouveau entrances, and those too were built for that 1900 fair, and in fact designed by a man named Hector Guimard, who was represented in this Inventing the Modern World exhibition with this lovely tall vase that is very much in this Art Nouveau style.
Who came to these fairs beginning in – because the first fair was in the 1700s, also in London, but in beginning in 1851, who would attend? Was this for the upper crust of society to get all dolled up and walk through and be seen and marvel at how wonderful we are? Or was this for common folk? Could ordinary people afford to go? Did they go?
I think it really was for everyone. I mean, at the 1851 fair, again, Queen Victoria was there, and she held court and on opening day as part of the inauguration of that fair. But artists and designers went to these fairs, and they were very deliberately going to look for inspiration, to see what their counterparts in other countries across the world were making. And ordinary people like you and me went, and we're awed by it. One of the things people can see if they come to see our exhibition is this about 5-minute loop of archival film footage from World's Fairs between 1900 and 1939. And it's this wonderful opportunity to see people dressed in their finery of the day, and the size of the crowds, and their part of the film footage includes the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco, and there are these huge throngs of people walking down Polk Street in San Francisco on the way to the fair, and there are marching bands, and people in native costume doing folk dances, and people playing football. So these were huge events with all kinds of activities going on.
And you had to stop the film after a certain period, because today we'd all be going in cutoffs, T-shirts, and flip-flops. It would not make for a good image on the film, I suppose. Why were these fairs so important that they kept having them over and over and over? I think I counted the number of fairs somewhere here between 1851 and 1939. It's an enormous number, far greater than the number of years involved. Why?
I think, well, remember, some of these World's Fairs lasted for 6 months. So this wasn't just a weekend fling. But I think there was such a motivation to show your best. Nationalism is one of the themes that runs throughout this exhibition. It was a chance for the technologies, the latest craftsmanship, show off. In 1851 in London, they were really looking at the French and going, we can do just as well as you can do. There was that really putting that nationalistic spirit, that cutting edge technologies, the latest designs, the latest architecture, which would house the booths and the pavilions, etc. So it was extraordinary.
Once these designs were displayed, and you mentioned Art Nouveau, but there are several other design motifs throughout this exhibit, because it spans so many years. Once they were shown at World's Fairs, did they catch on? Would you find them in the stores later on? Would the furniture style suddenly become adopted by people in their homes?
Absolutely.
In fact, there are a number of objects on view in the exhibition which are iconic for their time period and so timeless that they're still being made today. So, for instance, the Ludwig Mies van der Rohe Barcelona chair. It's called the Barcelona chair because it was debuted at the 1929 Barcelona exhibition, but it is still being made today. We have one in our collection at the Mint. I know people who have them in their living rooms at home. Alvar Aalto, one of the great leaders of modern Finnish design, created a vase that he called the Savoy vase, a glass vase, very sinuous in form. Again, there's one on view in the exhibition. That's still being made today, but it was originally made in 1933. So absolutely, people would go to these fairs and get a sense of what was truly cutting edge, what, you know, finger on the pulse design, and wanting to acquire something like that for themselves. Having said that, though, it is also true that these fairs were an opportunity to put on view truly singular objects, one-of-a-kind objects that are now owned by museums or maybe private collections, and again, a really important reason for people to come and see this exhibition because they won't get a chance to see some of these things again.
And we'll talk about some of them in the next segment because some of them are really, really remarkable objects. But was one of the functions of these fairs to make money? Did they make money or did they lose money? Or did they make money after the fact because the people who would display would then go on to sell what they displayed?
I'm not sure if countries always necessarily made money. In fact, the first large fair held in America was the 1876 Centennial Exhibition, and that was a money loser for us as a country. But we still went ahead and did the 1893 Columbian Exhibition in Chicago, and that was more lucrative, I think.
Did the Tea Party Republicans complain about that?
I haven't heard about that.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're talking about the World's Fair exhibit through January 19th at the Mint Museum downtown with Brian Gallagher, Stephen Plaxco, and Cheryl Palmer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, partnering with healthcare professionals and physicians in Charlotte and the surrounding area for over 30 years, dedicated to assuring safety and administering comfort. SEAnesthesiology.com. And Theater Charlotte presenting Arsenic and Old Lace, a classic comedy about the drama critic, the true love he might marry, and his crazy family. Now through November 10th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Well, thanks to a process known as fracking, the United States is building up enormous natural gas reserves, and some in North Carolina want in. Fracking is actually legal here, and with one more vote from the legislature, permits could be issued by 2015, but it's also a controversial practice. We'll take a look at both sides of this tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the number of deaths in the U.S. from narcotic painkillers has quadrupled since 1999. But the FDA's new recommendations for tightening restrictions on narcotics is prompting concerns about pain management. Debate over prescription painkiller regulations.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about a relatively remarkable and a kind of must-see exhibit at the Mint Museum, which has been open for a while now but runs to January 19th. It's about World's Fairs. World's Fairs from 1851 to 1939. We're here with the curator of decorative arts from the Mint, Brian Gallagher. Stephen Plaxco is the chief designer. We'll talk about how he laid out this exhibit in a few minutes here because it's pretty remarkable. It's on two floors. And Cheryl Palmer is director of learning and engagement for the museum. We've gotten a couple of emails that have come in while we've been talking. And Mark writes, don't forget the 1982 World's Fair was in Knoxville.
That's right.
I completely forgot. Right. So thank you for reminding me. Eric emails, when I was 10, my family attended the 1982 World's Fair in Knoxville many times during the months that it was there. I remember the excitement and interest so many had at seeing the exhibits from all the different countries. The theme of the 1982 fair was energy, and here, 31 years later, I still have great memories of seeing all the nationalities, trying many ethnic foods, and really being exposed to the world for the first time. That was the function of these, for many people, of these World's Fairs. In this internet age, in this television age, when we and in the movie age, where we see scenic shots of everywhere in the world all the time, and we can just type it on our computer, and I can see, you know, the South Pacific right now if I want to. Do they serve the same function, or have they moved to a different function? Because they are still being held.
That's a good question. One point that we make in the exhibition toward the end of the exhibition when we get to that 1939 period is that some 90-year period covered by the exhibition is when, again, these fairs really were the primary venue for artists and designers to show their latest creations, their best designs. What happens is, as Cheryl mentioned earlier, World War II then erupts, of course, and all the fairs that had been scheduled for the 40s get canceled. And by the time the fairs start up again in the mid-1950s, they really do take on a different tone. They become less about debuting important new designs and instead take on these large themes like some of your viewers have written in about. So they're tackling themes like the environment or urbanization or the economy. I think there are still important ways to find out about our global neighbors and to be exposed to new and exciting things and peoples that you didn't know before.
I want to talk about some of the firsts because I believe the Ferris wheel debuted for the first time at a World's Fair. I had said earlier that ice cream debuted. That's not true. It was ice cream cones.
Yes.
And I think that was Louisville.
Right. That's a pretty big one.
Television was on display at one of the World's Fairs.
1939, I think.
In New York.
Yeah,
but that's not part of your exhibit. I'm curious as to why, because that was the big deal. Had it not been for World War II, there would have been television in the 1940s. It wouldn't have come in the late 40s, early 50s. It would have been here right
sooner,
at the beginning of that decade. Why was the television not included in your exhibit?
That's a good question because it absolutely is the case that these World's Fairs displayed not just decorative arts but paintings and sculpture and innovations in technology like televisions. And the telephone was introduced at the 1876 World's Fair in Philadelphia, along with the typewriter. Heinz ketchup was introduced in that same fair. The Ferris wheel, as you mentioned, in 1893. So these fairs debuted a lot of different types of products, but the organizers of the exhibition, and they are, in fact, the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh and the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, had to stop somewhere, frankly, and because it's just such a big topic. So they decided to really limit their checklist for this to decorative arts objects in particular.
Okay. This is a traveling exhibit. I think this is the fourth stop and the last.
That's correct.
On the tour. I'm curious as to why only four stops, because it's really a magnificent exhibit. And why was it important for the Mint to bring this here?
Well, four stops because it's the people who actually own these objects want them back. It's these
by the
time
that.
Yeah, I know, by the time the exhibition closes in Charlotte on January 19th, the objects will have been away from their owners for 2 years. So that's a long time to ask anyone to part with something they love, whether it's a museum or a private owner. And then there are some conservation issues, of course, with where textiles and some of the furniture on view, you know, they really need to go back into storage and rest for a while after being under the bright lights of an exhibition space for a two-year period.
It's hard to travel, I would think, and very dangerous for some of these pieces.
Absolutely. And it was a logistically very complicated show to organize and travel. We had seven tractor-trailer trucks arriving at the Mint at regularly scheduled intervals from mid-August until mid-September, each truck just jam-packed with the objects in this exhibition, each packed in its own crate. We brought in some contract people to help us during the installation of the exhibition. Stephen and his staff were working 10 to 12-hour days Monday through Friday and then more hours on Saturdays and Sundays. So it was a very big deal for us and for every museum that took it.
The tagline on this is Travel the World at the Mint, because there are pieces from all over the world. Where are – give me some countries that these pieces come from.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, there are several layers of this world that we're talking about. There certainly are objects that were exhibited at fairs in Vienna or in Paris, several fairs that were held in Paris, or London or Chicago. So they're representing geographic sites where they might have been displayed, but it might have been the Japanese pavilion at one of these locations. So there's Japanese artists' work, which was exhibited in Turin, Italy, or in San Francisco, for example. And then there's a third layer, because perhaps a museum purchased that Japanese-made piece at San Francisco, and now its home is in Prague or Copenhagen or Budapest. The two co-organizing curators spent 10 years putting this exhibition together because they wanted hands-on, sight-on, seeing every single piece before they amassed the 200 pieces that are now on view.
That's the question I have, because there were so many World's Fairs from 1851 to 1939 and so many objects in those World's Fairs in that time period. Many of them, I suppose, are gone now. But how did they decide on the 200 that are in the exhibit? That must have been a monstrously difficult task.
I don't envy them, actually, although I'm sure it must have been a lot of fun to look at some 10,000 objects and wonderful things in museums and private collections across Europe and across America. I think what they really were trying to do was put together a great variety. So not only in terms of chronology, that is objects that represented the fairs from that 1851 first fair to 1939, but also in terms of medium. And so among the 200 objects that are on view at the Mint now include amazing works in ceramics, precious metalwork, furniture, textiles, glass, jewelry. So there's really something for everyone, I think, if they come and see this exhibition.
Now, Stephen, before you arrived at the Mint, you were at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain.
Yes.
Where you headed up the Department of Installation. You're the designer here. And you not only decided where in the Mint these objects would go and where within the exhibit space each area would be designated, you created a whole atmosphere for this, beginning from the moment you walk into the exhibit space. Is that not prescribed by the people who are putting this show on or letting these artifacts go, or could you have done anything you wanted to?
They were very generous with my freedom. They said, just do what you do and we'll back you up, and they were really good. And working with Brian was great because, you know, there were a few things that I came up with that he kind of went, that's a little bit too much. But we collaborated very well together. And we did this.
What got cut?
Well, I'll tell you.
I don't remember anything.
There was a great example when you go into the third floor, which is kind of the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. We had this beautiful Japanese screen, and I had if you come to the show, you'll see I had chosen several kind of thematic elements to carry through the entire exhibition, and one of those elements was the arch form,
right.
And upstairs on the fourth floor, we have a Gothic arch, and we have kind of a Renaissance regular lunette arch. And downstairs, I decided to go with this Japanese piece, a Japanese arch. And so I had also decided to use fabrics, drapery, like, you know, you'd see a lot during the Victorian age and even on through to the 20th century. And I had put a very simple kind of muslin scrim. And going with the Japanese theme, I had put a half of a red circle, which would have been kind of a draped Japanese flag. Mm-hmm. And Brian looked at it and he says, "That's a little bit too incendiary. I don't think that we want to talk about World War I just quite yet."
So what does exist is you've created this entryway, mm-hmm, that is reminiscent of World's Fairs and the pomp and circumstance,
exactly,
going into a World's Fair, and these arches that are throughout the, right, the show, and little pieces of drapery that highlight certain areas, which is what they would have done,
yeah,
in a World's Fair of the past, right?
Yeah, what they would have done, and you can see this in old photographs and in illustrations in the prints, including the prints that we have on display. They, during the Victorian era, they used, instead of building walls, which is what we normally do here, sometimes we use scrims, which are kind of cloth walls, mm-hmm, they would use big, big reams of really luscious kind of velvets and felts to separate spaces and to add, you know, backdrops. To everything was about adding drama. Mm-hmm. And they had this kind of frou-frou aesthetic, as you said yesterday. So instead of really using those fabrics as so much as a backdrop, I decided to use them kind of symbolically and to add, you know, highlights and a little bit of drama to the mix. So
what goes? You're the designer. So what goes through your head? You know, you have 200 artifacts. You know, they go from 1851 to 1939. I think you had a chance to see this exhibit elsewhere. So, what goes through your head as a designer? Where do you begin?
Well, you know, I begin by looking at the objects and studying up on my history, and talking to the curator and kind of finding out what Brian's ideas are about the installation. And I also looked at the other installations. This was really important. From the very beginning, I had lots of photographs from the other venues. And yeah, I think it starts out as a kind of taking away what I don't like from the other shows.
Hmm.
And the other shows, not to say anything, they all looked wonderful, but what they had all done was they had used a lot of colors. They had used a lot of paint colors. And, you know, coming from the Guggenheim, I've got kind of a more austere aesthetic to begin with. And so I decided from the very beginning that I wasn't going to try to imitate, you know, the salon in the house of a rich person, instead trying to kind of symbolically and from an ambience point of view, try to imitate the splendor of what a World's Fair would have been.
You know, not knowing any of that yesterday as we walked through it, one of the things that I came away with is that your eye, it's spare, and your eye is guided to the things, I think, that you want us to see.
Yeah. Well, we do this through
through
the flow, which, you know, even the pedestals and what we call risers, which are these platforms that all of the furniture pieces must go on top of. You know, the form of those are kind of designed to where you feel like you can walk this way without knocking your shin against a sharp corner. Mm-hmm. And lighting is extremely, you know, it's kind of like theater. Lighting is extremely, it's kind of a partner that we have in design. And it's something that you really don't see until the guy gets up on the ladder and starts hanging the cans. But you have to be able to visualize that before you start, or else you're sunk.
Right.
So
this is, what, 11 1,000 square feet?
It's a big space.
Is this the biggest exhibit that's been here?
Yeah, this is the first time since
then. King Tut or whatever it was?
Ramses. I think it equals Ramses, and that was in the 1980s, right? So it's been a really, really long time since the Mint has taken an exhibition this big, and it's the first time since Mint Museum Uptown opened in 2010 that we've used both floors as special exhibition galleries for a single exhibition.
The exhibit is 11,000 square feet, two floors. It's big, and yet it doesn't seem overwhelming.
Well, I think one thing that Stephen's design does so effectively that contributes to that feeling, and I'm glad you felt that way, is that we are the only venue of the four venues to which this exhibition traveled that put it on two floors. And so that was driven by necessity because we needed both floors of galleries to house this large exhibition. But it gave us an opportunity to play with that, with the design therefore. And so what Stephen did so effectively was put the first half of the exhibition, the 19th century part, on the fourth floor, the first gallery of the exhibition. And that installation is a bit more dense and therefore more Victorian in feel. You know, Victorians were known for their more is more aesthetic.
Yes, more is more.
and the checklist favors that. I would say probably 3/5 of the objects on the checklist are from the 19th century and 2/5 from the 20th. But then what happens is you get to the second half of the exhibition on our third floor, which picks up with 1902 and goes through 1939. And suddenly there's a lot more air around each object. Yeah. And each object is treated as its own kind of masterpiece. And you get this sense of space and of modernity, frankly.
Is that you? Is that your doing?
Yes, it is.
Yes,
thank you. But it also is, you know, about the space. And so I kind of, you know, I was looking at the space, and it was obvious that on the if we were to make that break at the century, then there would be less objects on the third floor. But it's instead of trying to fight that, you know, and say, oh gosh, we don't have enough here, embrace it.
Because sometimes when you go to some of these exhibits, you get fatigued because you're overwhelmed by what you're seeing. And there's so much. I remember going to one museum, we'll go unnamed, where I thought, okay, I get it, enough. And I was only 1/3 of the way through. But this, you kind of have, as you say, you have some breathing room toward the end, so you don't feel like you've been overwhelmed. You've seen a lot of stuff, no question.
Yeah.
But you feel like you've been directed in a certain order without any prodding. And you rest, you leave kind of feeling, well, I could see more. I want to see more. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you won't see more because you'll leave them wanting more. you begin – the first piece in the exhibition is this Tennyson cup. Give me the significance of that.
Oh, yeah. That's a great object. And that's an example of a singular object that I was, as I was mentioning earlier, a one-of-a-kind object. It's called the Tennyson vase. It's this very tall, probably about a 30-inch high silver vase named after Alfred Lord Tennyson, of course, one of the great men of letters of 19th century England. And it's this remarkable example of the silver repoussé technique. That is where the silversmith is hammering out a design on a flat sheet of silver to create a wonderful pattern in relief. And specifically on this Tennyson vase, the artist, a man named Armstead, a sculptor named Henry Hugh Armstead, was inspired by two poems by Alfred Lord Tennyson, La Morte d'Arthur, or The Death of Arthur, and Guinevere. So he's obviously looking at the Arthurian legend. Mm-hmm. And on the first side of this vase, we see Arthur and his fellow knights of the Round Table engaged in mortal combat with his archenemy, Mordred. The backside shows Arthur having succumbed to his wounds and being floated off to Avalon.
Let me stop you there because we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and RKM, Collector Car Auction. Classic high-performance cars like Mario Andretti's 1974 Indy car at Charlotte's Convention Center Friday through Sunday. Details at rkmcca.com. And Charlotte Children's Choir presenting the first concert of the season, Sounds of Hope, Saturday, 7 p.m. at First United Methodist. Tickets available at charlottechildrenschoir.com. www.worldsfairs.org. The number of deaths in this country from narcotic painkillers has quadrupled since 1999, but the FDA's new recommendations for tightening restrictions on narcotics is prompting concerns about pain management. That's the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes on The Diane Rehm Show. Help us celebrate 15 years of Charlotte Talks with a special interview featuring author Kathy Wright. It's next Wednesday at McGlowan Theater at Spirit Square at 7 p.m. Get details at WFAE.org. We'd love to see you there and for the reception afterward.
Many arts and cultural organizations in Charlotte are dealing with cutbacks in funding and donations. Leaders are looking for new ways to attract community support. WFAE's next public conversation will explore the outlook for Charlotte's cultural groups and how they hope to build a stronger future. Join us for this free community forum on Tuesday evening, November 12th at Spirit Square. Details and RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Today we're talking about World's Fairs, 1851 to 1939. Not in the abstract, but in the actual exhibit that's at the Mint Museum through January 19th. We have a video on our website of archival footage of World's Fairs, part of which you will see at the exhibit from 1900 to 1939. Really kind of neat. Old video from the Library of Congress, and you can check it out at our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. We were talking just before the break, by the way, with Brian Gallagher, curator of decorative arts, also with Stephen Plaxco, chief designer of this exhibit, and Cheryl Palmer, director of learning and engagement, all at the Mint. We were talking just prior to the break about the first piece in the exhibit, and that is the Tennyson vase, which is a remarkable work of art.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. I was saying before the break just how detailed and refined this repoussé technique in silver is realized on this vase, where it again depicts legend stories from the legend of King Arthur, and the heads of Arthur and his fellow knights of the Round Table are fully three-dimensional, and the chainmail armor is so realistic looking, and we have Guinevere weeping with her head in her hands, looking down on the carnage below of this battle scene in which Arthur is ultimately mortally wounded. So there's just so much going on iconographically. It's very fulfilling that way, and it's just a terrific example of silver.
And very important in the British historical tradition, and further into the exhibit, like 2 feet into the exhibit, there is this picture on the wall that shows what the World's Fair of that year would be to people when they saw it, but it also shows little scenes in the picture, if I recall correctly, of different countries around the world, but at the very top center is the Union Jack. So it is British perspective on the world, and
right.
They ruled the world back
that's
then.
Right.
Yeah,
it's their empire.
It.
There's kind of an echo of that in, I think, the 1876 World's Fair that we held in America, and there's an echo of that piece because in that era, there's the Karl Müller century vase and pedestal, which depicts the first 100 years of the United States. Talk about that.
Well, that's another great object. Unlike the Tennyson vase, which is all silver, this is a ceramic piece designed by Karl Müller, as you mentioned, made by Union Porcelain Works in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And just as the Arthurian legend was so important to England and captured on that Tennyson vase, here on the century vase we see this whole panoply of scenes from American cultural and industrial history, starting right off with a beautifully realized relief portrait of President George Washington. The vase has handles in the form of bison heads, a native species of America, of course, and then played out across both the lower register and the middle register of the vase are scenes depicting things like William Penn signing the treaty with the Indians, the Boston Tea Party, the invention of the sewing machine, the steamship, other agricultural equipment that were invented in America. So it's just this wonderful visual vocabulary, if you will, of American history. And so you can be sure that this was a way that America was putting its foot forward and saying, we have arrived, Europe, pay attention to us.
1876,
our centennial year.
And there's echoes of that, too. There's a lot of Tiffany pieces in this. And as I think one, I mean, maybe it was you, Cheryl, yesterday as we were going through, somebody said that Tiffany, through a lot of the work that they had on display, was saying, we're just as good as anybody anywhere in the world. Look at this.
That's right. That's right. And there's lots of Tiffany throughout both floors. Mm-hmm. They really had a presence at a number of the World's Fair. And actually, the archivist from Tiffany & Company is coming November 10th and is going to be speaking at the museum about Tiffany's presence there. But from silver coffee pots to, it was actually the jewelry that we were looking at yesterday. And there,
stunning.
There were Lalique and Fabergé, extraordinary pieces of jewelry. And then you turn the corner and there's a Tiffany. It was a corsage brooch, so it's larger than a normal pin. Mm-hmm. It was probably 6 inches long. And it was depicting an iris. But the stones, the sapphires, were from Montana. And it was very specifically American and meant to show off not just the technical skills of Tiffany folks, but it was homegrown products that were there.
Now, we have to talk about what I think is the most remarkable thing in the exhibit. And I could be wrong. It's purely my opinion.
Where this is going.
Yep.
But this is the Hashio Kiyoshi Japanese screen called Morning Sea. Describe, if you can, this piece.
No, it's absolutely breathtaking. And I think by just about all accounts, everyone who sees it comes away thinking that's their favorite object in the exhibition. So this is a large folding screen with four panels, has a beautiful black lacquer border with gilt mounts. But the scene that's played out across the four panels, this continuous scene of crashing ocean waves. And as you said, Mike, it's called Morning Sea. And as you approach this large screen, and it's the first object that greets you as you enter at the third floor, the second half of our exhibition, from, say, 15 yards away, even 10 or 7 yards away, you would be forgiven if you thought you were looking at a painting, possibly even a photograph. It's so highly naturalistic, these crashing waves.
And it moves as you move.
But when you get up to it, you realize it's not a photograph. It's not an oil painting. It's embroidered silk thread. Hashio Kiyoshi, this Japanese artist, realized this highly naturalistic image by using 250 shades of silk thread, embroidered silk thread, to create this. And it's just extraordinary. And as you just said, as you walk across this screen, in front of the screen, it seems to shift in color because, of course, one of the natural qualities of silk is that it shimmers in the light, just as water does when it's hit by morning sunlight. And so there's this wonderful verisimilitude to the piece.
How old is this piece? Does anybody know?
It was made for the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco.
Brand new.
I know. It's in great shape.
Absolutely, like it came off the floor of the artist's loft yesterday.
Yes. Yeah.
It's stunning.
It's been remarkably preserved.
It is worth the price of admission.
But I would say it's kind of a pity that we've given away the punchline because
if
you're listening to this, take your friends, a big group of them, and don't tell them. Let them guess.
That's right.
And then you can be the big hero when you bring them close and say, look.
It's silk thread.
It's an amazing piece of work.
Now, you, Cheryl, and Brian were particularly excited yesterday about this bookcase by Gustav Herder. This is an American piece, but it looks European.
It does. And it's another extraordinary piece. It is huge. It's probably 8-9 feet tall. It is carved bookcase, but it's closed. You're not seeing open shelves. Mm-hmm. The top looks like a Gothic cathedral.
Yes, it does.
It is very ornate in spires and not gargoyles and things like that. But then you go down the body of this bookcase, this huge piece, and you see carvings on the sides and the sections, section areas that are the muse. There's a sculpture represented and literature and visual art, lady with a palette, a painting, etc. But Herder, who was born in Germany but emigrated to the United States and worked for an American company, he started his company here, certainly was familiar with the Gothic tradition and the old traditions of Europe. But the wood he uses is all American wood. It's white oak, It's poplar. It's all the extraordinary color palettes and knottiness and grains of different woods that he uses in this sort of – it's both an homage to perhaps his homeland and to Europe, but it's very much proud of U.S. and looking forward, and it's just – it's huge and took like six guys to uncrate.
This is an example, Stephen, I think, of the challenge that you felt you met, because this came unassembled from IKEA. It came in six crates, and you had to put it together.
Well, we had to rent a giant forklift, and we had about six or eight guys sometimes putting it together. So it's not quite like putting together an IKEA kitchen, but
so they didn't supply the Allen wrench.
That's right. It didn't come with an Allen wrench. But Cheryl, actually, this thing is 13 feet high. This thing is one big monster of a piece of furniture. And I would like to say, you know, I brought my brother to see this show. And my brother's an automobile mechanic. He basically, you know, he's kind of a jack of all trades, and he lives at Home Depot. And this is a show that he loved, because it's not just, you know, it's not just for art snobs. It's for, you know, guys that do things.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Just in terms of the techniques and what you see that people back in the old days did with their hands, and you really get a huge appreciation of the way
things were made. It's about industry and craftsmanship as well as artistry and artistic examples.
Yeah.
As a designer, you must have felt like a kid in a candy store. Do you have a favorite piece?
Yeah, I would say that probably the there's another piece of furniture, which is the Wooten. It's a desk. And, you know, what another thing that we did differently, I tried to show the pieces more kind of in the round. I'm actually a sculptor by trade, and I studied sculpture. So my thing was, I want people like my brother to come in and be able to see the way things are made, not just, you know, the front, like the classic way that museums usually show things, or the front, the pretty side.
Right.
And so the Wooten desk is this incredibly ornate, complex, huge opening desk. What would be the technical term for this, Brian? I'm not sure.
It's called a cabinet secretary.
Yeah. And, I mean, it actually was an innovative piece of furniture as well, because they had to counterbalance it, because the doors were so heavy that, you know, if you had done it the normal way, they would have fallen over when the doors were open.
The doors hold file drawers,
right,
and even a leather opening, I mean, cubby holes.
Right.
It was like
amazing.
A PDA of the 19th century.
Wow. A couple of other things that will, I think, are amazing. The papier-mâché piano.
Yes.
You would never know to look at this thing that it is made of, I'm going to say it English way, American, papier-mâché.
I know. It's one of my favorites within the exhibition. It is an upright piano. It is playable, although we don't have the keyboard exposed, and it has a structure and a soundboard like
a typical piano. We don't get to touch these things, but you do. So did you play it?
No, they wouldn't let me play it either.
But the surface and even the little stool, mm-hmm, are this layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of paper, then lacquered, even inlaid with mother of pearl. One of the neat things about this exhibition, organized again by Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City and Carnegie, the Carnegie folks, my counterparts, the educators there, put together interactive stations that are scattered throughout the two floors of the exhibition. So there's a spot just around beside the piano, the papier-mâché piano, where you can touch papier-mâché. You can see layer upon layer upon, mm-hmm, layer. You get a sense of the technique and the craftsmanship that was put together in this one extraordinary piece.
The first public toilet, which is not on display, but it was debuted at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851. Exhibition goers then could not sit on it or use it, but it was there. You do have a very modern plate glass chair on display that people opted not to sit on because it was so heavy they didn't buy it.
That's right.
It was part of a dining room set.
That's
right.
Talk
about this chair, because it really is made out of glass.
It is. It was made by Pittsburgh Plate Glass, And it was one of the objects on view at the 1939 New York World's Fair, so the last World's Fair covered by this exhibition. It's a beautiful chair. It truly is a single sheet of glass that's slumped or kind of heated and shaped to form the entire back of this chair. Again, beautiful to look at, very sleek, very modern. Turns out not very practical to own because, as you alluded to, it's very, very heavy because this glass is quite thick. And because it is glass, it's, of course, also very fragile. So it just isn't the type of thing you'd want to use for your breakfast dining room table.
You wouldn't want to plop down in it.
Yeah.
At any given moment. One more thing I want to – the radioactive glass. There's a little piece of radioactive glass.
Oh, God, don't say it.
Right. That's right. We want people to come, Mike. No, I think the bigger point is the use of new materials. There's jewelry that's made of iron. There's a piece, a bracelet
that is
gold and aluminum. And the aluminum, which was as more expensive than silver, but was this new extraordinary product that had a look that could be combined with gold in a certain way. And again, the glass materials, they were using rare earth minerals. And in this one case, there's a button that our visitors can press, and it looks like a kind of gold, orangish colored piece of beautiful glass. Looks very modern, mm-hmm. Looks very contemporary. You press the button, it's green. It glows green.
And that's
with
because
light.
Of the uranium.
That's right.
William writes, "You're making me feel old. It's a small world ride and Carousel of Progress in the Magic Kingdom portion of Orlando's Disneyland or Disney World were built for the 64 New York World's Fair. Epcot Center was designed from the beginning to be a permanent World's Fair." So I guess that the United States will not be a source or a site for an official World's Fair again because evidently we refuse to pay our dues to the Bureau of International Expositions. That's pretty embarrassing, but also embarrassing, I understand, was that the U.S. Pavilion at the 2010 Expo in Shanghai, where 73 million people attended, was kind of paltry. Congress does not allot money for things like this, and so it housed only three videos. So the exhibit at the Mint, World's Fairs from 1851 to 1939, is the closest you're going to come to one in the U.S., and probably the best one you'll ever see. And it's at, it's at the Mint through January 19th. It is a must-see. Brian Gallagher, Stephen Plexco, and Cheryl Palmer, all from the Mint. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.